The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. Coming up on today's programme, exactly 1 year since the last elections to Northern Ireland's Assembly, but still no sign of a government being formed. Our very own Stephen Carroll reports from Belfast. Plus, we bring you an exclusive interview with the Chancellor's new economic adviser, Anna Valero. She's got a surprising take on the value of tax cuts.
But first, Lizzie, it is the morning after the night before. Results coming in from 230 councils across most of England. A massive set of local elections. Now, we still don't have a full picture, but fair to say, Lizzie, in broad terms, the Tories waking up to a bad set of results today.
Yeah, it does look like Rishi Sunak's set for a bruising first election result. He has already described it as disappointing. The Conservatives have already lost more than 200 seats in the first 1,600 that have been announced. Labour's made significant gains in seats like Medway, Stoke-on-Trent. I saw a pretty funny tweet from Philip Cowley, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London. Really, it's only expected to get worse. The morning's not been great. He says, I had expected that to be a relatively dull set of results. The amused bouche before today's counts got underway turned out to be more like a substantial starter.
Yes, looking quite tasty. A couple of things I want to highlight at this stage. The first is what I call tactical rewind. Remember, of course, before the 1997 election, there was massive tactical elections. Voters voting Tory, Labour in Labour areas and Lib Dem in Lib Dem areas to unseat their local Conservatives. That was a big problem for the Tories when they had that massive election defeat in 97. There was a big unwind of that tactical voting in 2015 with the collapsing of the Lib Dem vote. And I think we're seeing now, for the second election on the trot, a tactical rewind. Voters going back to the places that they can best unseat their local Conservative. That is a big problem for the government. And the second thing I think is interesting is a Brexit unwind. So there's been a massive polarisation over the last few years of voters along the lines of their Brexit vote. Brexity areas voting one way and Remain areas voting another way. And today we're seeing, by the signs of it, quite a lot of evidence of an unwind of that Brexit vote. So moving back towards Labour from in Leave areas.
But let's just take a step back and think about why this matters in the big picture. Really, it's symbolic because it's the first and possibly last chance to test how much the opposition Labour leader Keir Starmer's poll lead is translating into real results. results ahead of the general election next year. If you think back to the history, you always like to do this, you and Labour regularly made gains in local elections in the run-up to Tony Blair's 1997 landslide. But we do have to caveat it, of course, by saying that you can't directly transpose local elections onto national elections. They do tend to be dominated by local issues, the likes of potholes and bins. The Liberal Democrats tend to outperform. But I'll just draw on the wisdom of John Curtis, the polling expert. He says if Labour can secure a double-digit vote share lead overall, there's a pretty sure sign that they're going to win a parliamentary majority next year.
Yeah, clearly a bad step, but are they bad enough for the Tories to lose and for Labour to get a majority at the general election? That is the key question. Well, let's chew this over with YouGov's Patrick English. He's Associate Director in the Political and Social Research Team. Patrick, thank you for waking up for us this morning. what time did your night shift end?
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Yes, I clocked off at 8 a.m. this morning, so just a couple hours kip to get back on the ride now.
Goodness, that is not very long ago. What's your broad assessment of how the parties should be feeling at this point?
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So at the moment, as we look with the sort of the Friday results just starting to come in, what we can say is that it looks like a pretty bad set of local election results for the Conservatives. They've been losing seats. They've been losing with quite large swings to Labour in some key areas, looking at Plymouth, looking at Stoke, looking at Medway. Councils where that cover marginal constituencies, the kind of constituencies that Labour need to win to build a parliamentary majority in 2024. They've also been losing to Liberal Democrats in some key con Lib Dem battlegrounds too. So we saw Windsor and Maidenhead that actually went directly from the Conservatives to the Liberal Democrats. They put on an enormous amount of seat wins there to take that council directly off the Conservatives. In fact, we can now say that King Charles has a Lib Dem councillor, which is quite something, really. So I think we're going to see these trends, I think, perhaps even to a greater degree today. We have to wait and see. Most councils still haven't even started declaring results. We've got lots of data to come in. But certainly at the moment, it doesn't look like a bad night for the Conservatives, a pretty good one for Labour, and a good one for Liberal Democrats as well.
Patrick, Ewan mentioned the Brexit unwind trend. How much are we seeing it? How important is it for Labour?
Yes, it does seem to be. When we look back, particularly if we look back to even pre-Brexit baselines, if you like, that Labour are recovering a lot in areas that previously deserted them in sort of leave voting middle and northern England. There, they seem to be winning back, or at least sort of on the aggregate form, winning back a lot of those places and voters who went Conservative, often via UKIP, between sort of 2015 to 2021. As you correctly said, we saw this trend sort of start to emerge in the 2022 results, and there's been a continuation of it now. In fact, if we look at the aggregate figures, based on last year, Labour are around about static. So if we look at the change in the wards that the BBC are covering as part of our key wards exercise from 2022, Labour are only up just about a fraction of a point. The Conservatives are down. But then if we go back to 2019, Labour were up 7 points. So in terms of the national long-term trend, Labour are probably still just about where they were this time last year. It's the Conservatives who are continuing their nosedive. And a lot of that nosedive is in these heavily leave voting areas. But of course, the results overnight did tend to lean towards more leave voting areas. So they were going to be focusing on the blue wall. So lots of councils in that remain voting, degree heavy, commuter belt zone, I guess, around London. And that is going to be key, I think, for the Conservative Liberal Democrat story. So we may even see the Conservatives do as badly in remain voting areas too.
Now, you're an opinion pollster. How do you rate the performance of the two parties this week relative to their recent opinion poll performance?
That's a really good question. I think what we can broadly perhaps say, although, of course, we need to wait for this projected national share, which will be coming later today on Friday, we can broadly say that this is about the sort of council election result we would expect given where the opinion polling is right now. So a decent endorsement for the pollsters, I guess. We're on to something, I think, with this idea that Labour are ahead, the Conservatives are struggling, and the gap is significant. Will it be enough to win a general election? Well, we're going to have to wait and see, right? That's probably more than a year away. A lot can happen in between now and then. However, this is the kind of local election performance that a party, an opposition party, who is sort of 10, 15 points ahead in the polls would be putting on. that we can see so far.
So, Patrick, you mentioned some of the key seats that you're watching out for. Which are the ones that are most interesting? What should we be watching out for the rest of the day?
Yes, so overnight it was places like Plymouth, Stoke and Medway that were capturing the imagination. Today, we've already had Windsor come in, and I think it's going to be those Conservative Lib Dem battlegrounds that are really, really going to pique our interest today. So we're looking at places like East Cambridgeshire, we're looking at Wokingham, we're looking at Maidstone. These remain voting, degree heavy, lots of young professionals, lots of demographic change, with Conservative incumbent MPs and councils looking very nervously over their shoulder at the Liberal Democrats. How many of those councils can the Lib Dems take? They've already taken Windsor, and that would signal bad news if you're a Conservative in Cambridgeshire, Wokingham or Maidstone, but that's going to be a fascinating set, I think, around that sort of East and London surrounding area. Those councils with the Liberal Democrats are pushing to try and take control.
You're certainly looking like a good night for the Lib Dems, particularly given they had tough comparables. They did well in 2019, which cannot be said for Labour or the Conservatives. Mm. Patrick, I want to ask you about the national share, because this is something which is, I guess, it gets cephalogists excited, isn't it? Tell us what we think the PNS will be and why it matters for Labour at the next general election.
Yes, I think another quick aside to the 2019 base size, of course, the Green Party had a very, very, very good, their record, in fact, set of results in 2019. And as far as we can tell right now, they look to be matching that. So they're quite happy with their result. Well, an interesting council for them would be Mid-Suffolk. They think they might be able to take that off the Conservatives today. So that'll be really interesting to see. Now, in terms of that projected national share, what we're doing sort of with the BBC coverage here is when we have a very healthy amount of wards in from all the different areas that are voting, that voted on Thursday, we will use that information to try and project how the rest of the country might have voted if the whole country was holding local elections on the Thursday. And that gives us a really important picture of where the party is at across the whole of Great Britain, not just in the areas that did actually vote. Of course, heavily caveated, we're basing that only on the areas that did vote. You can't compare it to a general election vote share because parties like the Liberal Democrats and the Greens and others and independents, for example, do far better at local contests than they do in general elections. But it gives us a really good indicator, particularly if you look back over time and see, well, how does that projected national share, are Labour 10 points ahead? How does that compare to last year? How does it compare to the year before? The PNS in 2019, by the way, had Labour neck and neck with the Conservatives at 28 to 29%. So they'll certainly be looking to improve on that. Can they stretch it out to 10 points? We'll have to wait and see.
And Patrick, when I look on Twitter, various Tory MPs have got their own diagnoses for what's gone wrong here. Charles Walker says they're not building enough homes for people. John Redwood says it's high taxes, big government. Raymond Chishti says Suella Braverman's comments on migration are to blame. What is the bottom of this? You know, is it too early to tell where it's gone wrong?
Well, certainly the full set of results will give us a better indicator of exactly what's happening in terms of the geography. But perhaps it is the case that all of them may have something to say, may be right. The fact is the Conservatives are caught in a perfect pincer movement right now between Labour in the sort of Midlands and in the North and the Liberal Democrats pushing them hard in the South. So there's lots of different things that are probably playing on voters' minds. There are, of course, always local issues in local elections too. So potholes come into it as much as Brexit does. So there's really probably something for everyone to be worried about and everyone to pick out in what is a pretty poor set of elections for an incumbent party that's been there for 13 years in terms of Westminster government.
Patrick, lovely stuff. Thanks so much for joining us on 3 hours sleep, an impressive performance. That's YouGov's Patrick English.
Today marks 1 year since the last elections to Northern Ireland's Assembly, but there's still no sign of a government being formed there. That's despite an abundance of optimism about the region's economy. And our very own Stephen Carroll has been off on his travels. He's been looking at this and he's back with us, I'm happy to say, in the studio.
Lizzie, I've been trading places with you as the person who's allowed out of this studio to go and
see what's going on in the world.
Yeah, no, you're stuck here, Leo, and we're not going to review. Look, I was interested in this because Rishi Sunak has been talking about Northern Ireland's economy being in this unique and privileged position of accessing the UK and EU markets. What we heard from Joe Biden when he was in Northern Ireland, that there could be massive American investment going there if power sharing government is restored. So how hopeful are businesses and people in Northern Ireland about that promise of prosperity? I went to Belfast to find out. When you're thinking about the past and the future of Northern Ireland's economy, the waterfront in Belfast is a good place to start. We're in the shadow of the cranes of the Harland and Wolff shipyard, but also now lining the banks of the Lagan are glittering office blocks. The latest has seen the likes of American law firm Baker McKenzie move in. The hope here is that after the Windsor Framework Agreement and promises of American investment from US President Joe Biden, is that there's more of those sort of businesses that will come here.
Absolutely, we've seen American interest, and we've seen that interest before in Joe Biden's visit and before the Windsor Framework. I would expect to see much greater interest and further proliferation of that interest.
That's Joe O'Neill, CEO of Belfast Harbour, one of the biggest commercial property owners in the city.
I am Belfast Harbour. I am the rise and the fall of the tide. I am the breath and the life and the pride.
This poem was commissioned to mark the port's 175th year. It talks of a long tradition of innovation. For Joe O'Neill, the Windsor Framework deal on post-Brexit trade rules brings the possibility of a new beginning.
I think we're only just starting to see global companies, global manufacturing companies now looking at Belfast and the region with more detail, because I think they've got a certainty that, yes, this feels tangible now, and this feels like an opportunity that we should be seriously assessing.
That opportunity is something the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has been keen to highlight.
Northern Ireland is in the unbelievably special position, unique position in the entire world, European continent, in having privileged access not just to the UK home market, but also the European Union single market.
So can the region capitalise on this unique position? The Bank City is one of the biggest private sector employers in Northern Ireland, with over 3,700 staff. Lee Mayer leads its operations in Belfast.
One of the challenges is that people need to understand that Northern Ireland is exactly the same as any other part of Europe or of the UK, and that, you know, we really have the same kind of expertise.
Mayer says the relative size of the region has helped them to tackle skills shortages experienced elsewhere, particularly in technology.
We have this ability to influence curricula for degree and post-degree purposes at the universities. So if we had something in a particular language that we wanted to focus on, we would be able to speak to the university and see if we could put a module of that particular language into the degrees.
But Northern Ireland suffers from a graduate brain drain. Research from 2021 found just over a third of those who left to study in Great Britain came back to work in the region afterwards. That's part of the reality facing the generation who grew up here since the 1998 peace agreement. Those like 27-year-old Sean Ogle.
I've had an awful lot of friends that have moved away, actually, to a big mix of places. And I think most have moved for economic reasons, most have moved for work, which is, you know, quite sad, because I do think that a lot of them would have stayed here if the opportunities had presented themselves.
Emer Smith, who's also 27, is training as a barrister in Belfast.
If I was only going on the economy, I wouldn't stay here. My choice to become a barrister and to stay here isn't because I think that Northern Ireland is a great place to live or a great place to raise a family or a great place to have a great career. My reason to stay here is because I think that there is potential in Northern Ireland, and I would like to wait and to see if that happens and to be a part of that change.
The missing piece of this puzzle is the lack of a functioning government in Northern Ireland. The Stormont Assembly Building, set in rolling parkland overlooking Belfast, lies dormant. There hasn't been a power-sharing executive sitting here in 15 months. Lee Mayer from City says business has had to carry on.
Over the last 5 years, we probably haven't had an executive for more than a year. And so we've had to move forward. And I think that what that is doing is it's actually building the confidence of the business community to make effective decisions and grow the business, their businesses and the economy, irrespective of whether they've got support from the government. We would like that to change. We would like to have a sitting executive.
A sentiment shared by Joe O'Neill from Belfast Harbour.
Political stability goes to the heart of most foreign direct investment decisions. So I think we can't hide that if we were able to signpost and offer that reassurance to foreign direct investors that there is a sitting assembly, that is clearly beneficial. But in the meantime, it hasn't stopped us, particularly in Belfast Harbour, with pushing ahead with our investment plans.
While business may be able to press on, Emer Smith and Sean Ogle feel the sense of missed opportunities.
I would really encourage political leaders to lead from the front. There's a thing that I always think is missing, and that's political grace. There comes a point in time where you have to actually be able to make decisions that are for the greater good.
It's deeply frustrating because I really do want it to succeed. I think there is so much positive things to sing and dance about Northern Ireland. You know, there's so much going for it, yet we're being so held back by things that are legacy issues from the past.
As ever in Northern Ireland, the past looms large over the present. As the paralysis at Stormont continues, the question now is whether its politicians can focus on the future.
Stephen, it's 15 months now, isn't it, since Northern Ireland's had a functioning government. What's the situation like in terms of breaking the political deadlock? Are we any nearer to that?
We're not. The Democratic Unionist Party still says it isn't happy with the post-Brexit trade rules for Northern Ireland, despite the Windsor framework being designed to resolve their issues. And look, this isn't an unusual situation for Northern Ireland to find itself in. In fact, they've had periods of up to 3 years where there's been no government in Stormont either. So the question of whether there could be a deal done to bring the DUP back to the table is still up in the air, because it has happened to the past that negotiations have managed to yield a compromise that's allowed the return of power sharing. But there's nothing immediately on the horizon to suggest that's in question. One of the pressures, though, that is new is the fact that the Northern Ireland Secretary, Chris Heaton-Harris, has had to set the budget for Northern Ireland because of the fact that there's no functioning executive in Northern Ireland. And that has meant that there's going to be £800 million worth of spending cuts by Northern Ireland's government. That's affecting very much day-to-day issues, like we heard Eimear Smith in that report talking about the health service. For example, the health service in Northern Ireland has the longest waiting lists of anywhere in the UK. It's facing a shortfall now in its budget of £470 million this year. This is because the budget allocated to the Northern Irish government can't be properly administered by the civil servants who are in place, given that there are no ministers there either. Those are the sort of issues that you can expect are going to be very important when we have local elections in Northern Ireland in 2 weeks' time.
Yes, our local elections on the 18th of May. Stephen, thank you for returning to the studio.
I'll be back, don't worry.
Now, another topic that's going to be weighing in the run-up to the next general election is, of course, taxes. Lots of expectation within the Conservative Party and hope that the Chancellor will cut them before next year. Cutting them was a big part of Liz Truss's disastrous mini-budget too, and even now backbench Tory MPs are pushing for a cut to the corporate tax rate. So it was all the more surprising that the Chancellor's new adviser, Anna Valero, is saying she thinks there are better things the government could be doing with the money. I spoke to her exclusively in this interview for the podcast.
Well, I think restoring growth in the UK is of fundamental importance right now. And when seeking to do that, we need to be looking at productivity growth. This is the area where we've been doing particularly badly since the financial crisis versus our own history versus other international comparators. And this is the sustainable way to improve living standards. So if we want to get real wages and living standards improving again, we need to improve productivity.
So you say that the Chancellor should focus on growth and productivity, but his number one priority is halving inflation by the end of the year. Is that wise when really it's the Bank of England's mandate to control inflation and there's not much the government can do about it?
Well, when we look at inflation, we know a lot of what's driven it up so high recently has been the energy crisis, of course. And for that reason, forecasters expect inflation to come down. There are, however, domestically driven parts of that. We've seen this kind of persistence in the core inflation, and we've seen particularly high food price inflation in the most recent data. So this is obviously really important when we're considering households and living standards. But as you say, monetary policy is there to set interest rates with the aim of bringing inflation under control. But I think we have to be thinking about living standards as a fundamental reason for getting growth improving, and also the interplay, obviously, between fiscal and monetary policy.
And in the latest public finance data, we saw that the Chancellor won a bit of additional fiscal headroom. Is it wise to spend it on cutting taxes, as many in his party are calling for, ahead of the next election? Is that a wise way to grow the economy in the longer term?
Well, my personal view is that if it was as easy as cutting taxes, then we would have seen that during the years that we had particularly low corporate tax, for example, as the main rate of corporate tax was 19%, perhaps we would have seen slightly higher business investment. I think the tax environment matters, but there are many other things we need to be doing for improving growth. And also within the tax environment, we can be thinking about incentives for investment rather than the headline rate.
And what really held back growth in February were the strikes. Is it time for the Chancellor to settle with the unions?
Well, I think this is obviously a very complex problem. We've had our public services under strain for a very long time. We've had a cost of living crisis, which has meant that while perhaps public service workers were able to deal with their wages that weren't rising some time, then suddenly there's this massive inflationary shock, which has been persisting, and that makes it all the more difficult. So I think if we're thinking sustainably for the long term for the UK, we need to ensure we have good quality public services. We need to make sure that people are working in the public services. So I would want to see some kind of resolution there.
And when it comes to growth, one way that the Chancellor has proposed to grow the economy is through pooling pension funds to invest in British firms. How would you advise him to do that to maximise investment and minimise risk?
Well, when we're looking at how to actually get investment into British businesses, one of the key areas we're all looking at currently is pension funds. This is a massive kind of source of domestic savings. The defined contribution schemes in particular are quite fragmented. So this kind of agenda for consolidating some of those smaller schemes, allowing them to have perhaps more of a risk appetite and economies of scale in some of the fees that are involved with investing in more risky assets, this seems like a promising avenue to pursue if we want to get investment into British businesses and more productive long-term projects.
But even if you can get that investment into British companies, how do you prevent them from listing elsewhere, just as Arm has done?
Well, we have seen this kind of decline in the London Stock Exchange for some time in terms of volume, in terms of our listings. People have attributed this to different things. Some have really pointed to the exit of our pension schemes from UK equities over time since the early 2000s. Others have talked about perhaps just less of a promising growth prospects for the UK in general, less buoyancy, less dynamism. And of course, there's Brexit, which has made some companies consider perhaps Europe and other European destinations. So I think what we do need to be thinking about how to make the UK an attractive place for businesses to be listing. That's fundamentally also thinking about the new economy, the sectors of tomorrow. Many look at our listed companies and say, actually, this reflects more the economy of the past. So how can we get the tech companies, which we know we're great at, the startups, how can we get them to scale up? And then crucially, rather than simply moving elsewhere or being purchased by international firms, contributing to growing the jobs and the productivity of the UK economy.
I mean, you mentioned Brexit. In one of your blogs that you wrote before becoming an economic advisor to Jeremy Hunt, you were quite openly anti-Brexit. To grow the economy and cut inflation, does the government need to accept that closer ties with the EU are essential?
Well, I think, you know, many economists would agree that it wasn't good for the economy, for our productivity, to erect large-scale trade barriers with our closest and largest trading partner. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about goods, but we are actually a services exporting superpower. So we need to be thinking about maintaining our exports and services, maintaining regulatory closeness with the EU. And then when we're thinking about emerging technologies as well, I think it's really important, rather than seeking to diverge across all areas, thinking about where we actually need to be aligned in order to make sure that we can trade seamlessly along complex international value chains with Europe and other partners too.
One exciting hope on the horizon for UK growth is AI. Is the government being proactive enough about regulation of AI, in your view?
Well, I think AI, obviously, we've all seen recently with ChatGPT, the massive advances that are possible. For some time, many people have been talking about how AI has massive potential for improving productivity in advanced economies such as the UK. We also have kind of expertise in that area with a number of AI startups. Perhaps now we're seeing more tangibly some of the power of AI in our everyday lives in different professions. Of course, there are a number of things we need to be thinking about there. First, how do we do this in a way that will actually complement workers rather than replace them? And second, how do we actually think about the regulation in a proactive way so that we can anticipate risks, financial risks, ethical risks, rather than have to react to them when potentially it's too late?
And is there a risk that net zero is becoming something of an afterthought in the growth story as well?
Well, my personal view is that it's not becoming an afterthought in the sense there's a lot of momentum, including the government's, well, the independent review of net zero led by Chris Skidmore, the government's response. I think we're moving in a direction to mainstream net zero into our growth story. There's obviously much more that can be done. We need a more long-term stable environment for policy, for public support, because that's what's required to get businesses to invest in the UK in long-term, sometimes risky projects, particularly in an environment where we have much more international competition now with the Inflation Reduction Act in America.
And finally, Bloomberg's reported that Labour's planning to change its fiscal rules by treating the government's accounts a bit like a company so that assets are included as well as debt in a net worth model. Is that an idea that you'd advise the Chancellor to adopt?
I think this makes sense because it allows you to take a more holistic view of the health of the public finances. It allows you to think about the value of the things that public sector investment goes into, which we know is of fundamental importance, whether it's our schools, our hospitals, whether it's net zero energy infrastructure. These things have value for the long term. So actually trying to reflect that value with all the challenges that will entail, because valuing some of these different assets would be tricky, will be important as part of a package of fiscal rules. I think it will reduce some of the incentives that we've had for governments to cut public sector investment when times get tough fiscally. It's often one of the easiest things to adjust politically. But what we need is a bit more stability in our public sector investment, and also not necessarily having the incentive to sell off assets at a time that might not maximise value for the taxpayers.
So that was Anna Valero, a senior policy fellow at the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance, also a new economic advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, here in the UK. I have to say, Ewan, I was baffled to hear her being so openly anti-Brexit, saying she doesn't want to cut taxes as a priority, she wants to settle the strikes, and she's backing Labour's plans for net worth fiscal rules that we talked about on this podcast just the other day. I wondered whether this is an indication of what the Chancellor himself thinks, or whether we should give him some kudos for listening to views that perhaps don't agree with his own.
A bit of thinking outside the box. I can hardly think of an election in recent memory where tax cuts haven't been part of the Tories' offer, the Tories' retail offer, and I'm sure it will be at the next election as well. But fascinating that he's got this new advisor.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock, and our audio engineer was Marifal Hussain. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Lizzie Bird, and we'll be back after the long bank holiday weekend. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.